In the name of one God, creator, redeemer, and sustainer of our lives, amen. This is one of those Sundays where I really didn't have a clue what to do with the texts. It's like I came back from vacation too early. I should have had Carla preach on this one. You can often tell by the photo on the cover how I'm feeling about the text. I don't know if anybody paid attention to the photo on the cover. Does anybody recognize the photo on the cover? Right. It's Luke and Darth Vader. And I don't want a spoiler alert. But this is a father fighting his son, right? And Jesus says, I did not come to bring peace, but I came to bring division. Father against son, son against father. I was like, oh, Star Wars. Right? And there's a deeper spiritual truth there, I'm sure, that if we think about it deeply, we could probably uncover. So, you know, as I wrestled in with these texts and I started the end of it, Jesus has said, well, you know how to tell the weather, like you know how to tell when, you know, the weather's going to be good, you know how to tell the weather when it's going to be bad. Well, why can't you read the signs of the times? Do you know how to read the signs of the present time? And you know, it's got me thinking about, so it's about reading the present time. There's a kind of a seriousness. Jesus says, I have this baptism of fire that I have to bring, that I want to bring. There's this element of division. There's this kind of this seriousness. There's this apocalyptic nature to these texts, both in Luke and in Jeremiah. The Jeremiah text is also about God coming with his word is like fire and a hammer, hammering out a sword, and it's this, you know, God speaking against the prophets who aren't doing their job, the prophets who aren't leading people towards God. They're leading people towards the Baals, and God, which is the other gods, the darker gods. And it's like, well, so there's a seriousness to all these texts, and there's a seriousness to these times in which we live in. I was reflecting, well, do I know how to read the signs of the times? And I think about the things that worry me, the things that, you know, July was now listed as the hottest month on record since they've been keeping statistics. It's worse than that. There's like 415 consecutive months that are hotter than they've been. And the last, you know, the top five hottest years are all within the last decade. And there's a real sense that you know, climate change is becoming more pronounced. The UN announced that, you know, there's over a million plants and animal species that are on the verge of extinction. At the same time, when, you know, in the United States, they scale back the Species Protection Act, you know, that would have protected species. And then I heard on the CBC that BC doesn't have a Species Protection Act, right? And so, like, we're in a situation where, you know, I'm worried about the planet. I'm worried about the future of the planet. Spending time with my nieces, I'm worried about what the future is going to look like for them. I was at the General Convention, and there was a 14-year-old kid, a 15-year-old kid who got up at the General Convention that wanted us as a church, it wasn't the General Convention, it was the Synodical Convention, or the Diocesan Convention in May, who wanted us as a church to take climate change seriously. And he said, I'm worried about the lives of my kids and my grandchildren. And here's a 14-year-old who's worried about the lives of his kids and his grandchildren. And are we listening? Are we taking that seriously? I'm worried about the nature of democracy in our world. The polarization south of the border and increasingly the way in which we vilify those people we disagree with and make a character of them and don't speak truth anymore. This era we've fallen in where division is being created amongst us that's based on falsehood. I was like, we need to rescue it depends upon how you count them, but we need to rescue the ninth commandment. Thou shalt not bear false witness against thy neighbor. Which is to say, you shouldn't lie about your neighbor, or you shouldn't tell lies about your neighbor. Which means, you know, if your neighbor and you disagree with your neighbor about something politically, you need to be truthful about what they believe. You need to be truthful about who they are. You can't tell lies about them to make your own political point. You can't, And I'm like, well, why aren't we as Christians, why aren't evangelicals in the United States standing up for the ninth commandment? We need to be, all of us, across the board, standing up for the ninth commandment. That we're at least telling the truth and we aren't telling the lies. And in a world of false narratives and spin, that we are standing up that we're being as truthful as we possibly can be. You know, we've look at what's going on in both south of the border and what's happening in Hong Kong, and you know, there's this fight over, you know, it's who are we going to worship? What are we going to stand up for? Are we going to stand up for freedom and self-determination, or are we going to sacrifice our freedom and self-determination to the gods of comfort and stability? Chinese economy has done great. I mean, the mainland Chinese economy has done phenomenally well. And in the last couple of decades, right? And the people of Hong Kong are saying, we don't want the cost of that kind of stability. We want to preserve our freedoms. I worry about refugees. You know, climate refugees, political refugees. You know, part of the tensions in Europe and North America are around the influx of people who are different than we are, immigrants, refugees. It's just going to get worse. I mean, as the climate shifts, as governments become more unstable, those kind of dynamics, like these are the signs of the times. These are the things I worry about. Like, am I reading it right? Are we getting it right? Are we taking it seriously enough, right? And in the context of that, who are the gods that we're worshiping? Who are the gods that we're relying on? Who are the gods that we're counting on? Are we relying on the gods of our culture, of the gods of consumerism, the gods of wealth, the gods of comfort, the darker gods? Or are we kind of seeking out what may be, you know, worshiping the God of grace, the God of life, the God of hope? So am I reading the signs of the times wrong? What does it mean when Jesus says he's coming with fire? You know, there's this apocalyptic literature. It always sounds very threatening and ominous, as if, you know, fire is going to destroy, as if fire is going to punish. And yet, actually, fire is used many ways in the biblical text. Often fire is used as one of cleansing, one of refining, actually one of purifying. Actually, fire can be a good thing. Fire can be a life-giving thing. How are we open to the fire of God? How are we as a people open to whatever the fire of God is doing? So in the midst of my existential despair around all these things, I watch documentaries like one I watched last night on Woodstock. Great documentary. I didn't know so much about Woodstock. I was not old enough to have been there. Some of you might have been old enough to have been there, but it's this phenomenal little thing that happens out in the rural part of upstate New York, where you get 400,000 kids coming to a music venue where they don't have the infrastructure and security and porta potties and food to sustain it, right? And there have been other music venues throughout the 60s, you know, where that had come, that kind of devolved into violence, and there was violence on the periphery and stuff like that. And so there's all this worry about Woodstock. This was the dawning of the age of Aquarius, and everybody was into peace and love, right? Some of you are old enough to remember the dawning of the age of Aquarius. We're seeing how that turned out, right? Didn't quite live up to the promises, right, of what it was built to be. But there was actually, you know, to their credit, this three-day music event that had phenomenal acts like The Who and The Grateful Dead and, you know, Sly and the Family Stone and Janis Joplin and all kinds of folks, it overall went off relatively well, which is actually part of what's phenomenal about the whole thing, because they weren't prepared for that many people. It could have devolved into chaos. It didn't devolve into chaos, and part of that was the character of the kids. These kids who had hope, these kids who had vision, these kids who were thinking about, you know, they had hope for a better world. They, you know, they did have hope for peace. They did have hope for love. You know, they were trying to kind of live into that. However imperfectly they did that, they were trying to live into that. But part of what I was curious about is, part of what helped hold the whole thing together is that the young organizers who were relatively inept and didn't know really how to get it all done, they hired a security, this commune called the Hog Farm. And the head of the commune was a guy named Wavy Gravy, who was kind of a character, right? He was kind of a goofy character back in the day. Still is. Is he still alive? All right, so he's still alive. But what was interesting, and it was a good choice, because the organizers knew that if they hired cops, and this was a tension where there's all this, you know, among these kids, this tension between authority and the authority structures, and if they hired, you know, policemen and or National Guards units, you know, there's just going to be this tension that's going to lead to fire. So you don't hire those folks for security. You hire the most unlikely, goofy kind of clown to be your security, and it actually worked. Because the kids were like, he knew how to kind of interact with people. And what happened is this commune, these were folks who were trying, you know, this alternative, you know, way of living. This commune became the thing that helped hold it all together. When they ran out of food after that first night, and it's a three-day event, the local community heard out, and the good people of that local community cleaned out their pantries and sent whatever they had, pickles and olives and hard-boiled eggs and whatever, to the concert site. So these good people of rural New York who were politically conservative, who didn't want to have anything to do with these hippies, said, they're hungry and we need to feed them. So first of all, they did that. And then so all this food comes. And so this people in this commune called the Hog Farm got together and they cooked the food and they made the food and they were giving this food out free. So here's this cluster of people who are operating actually like a church. They're operating like a community of people, a functional community of people. They're making food that comes in to give to the hungry people. They set up, you know, there's a lot of drugs going on at Woodstock, so there's a lot of people going on bad acid trips. So they're setting up tents where these people can come and lay and recover from the freakout tents. I think that's what they were calling them, freakout tents. You know, I mean, I'm not saying you have to agree with any of this, right? You could be like, well, you know. But what I found curious about it is the reason it wasn't more of a disaster than it could have been was that there was a group of people who came together and they helped other people. They came together with a sense of cohesion, a sense of belonging to each other, this commune, and they provided food for the hungry. They provided, you know, these places of refuge for people who are having bad trips. They provided security and order in friendly, kind ways. And this 168 people, which the organizers had flown in a jet from New Mexico to New York just so they could be there, helped hold things together. And for me, it's like, okay, there's a ray of hope. There's a model for a ray of hope, because this is the church. When we together come together as people, as the body of God, and embody kind of God's presence in this world, we're part of that refining fire. We're part of the hope. You know, yesterday there were people, we had a memorial service for Esme Walker here yesterday. And, you know, there were about 112 people here in this building. Three-fourths of whom were not from St. Lawrence, but there was a core group of folks from St. Lawrence here, some of whom were here for 8 hours yesterday, volunteering their time. The choir was here yesterday, volunteering their time, right? We together came together as church yesterday, and it was a lovely memorial service, and we honored the life of this woman who had been a faithful member of this congregation. And we reached out to the larger, wider community of folks who were here yesterday in this place. Yesterday, we did a good job of being church, right? We do, and modeled that well. We do a good job of being church when, you know, we reach out to those who are sick and suffering. We do a good job of being to church when we're offering to give rides to folks who are having a hard time getting around. We do a good job of, I thought we did a great job of being church when we hosted the MAP program last spring. and invited the hungering and the homeless and the into our home, and we housed them for a month last spring. We do a good job of being church every time we come here to worship and give praise to the God of life, to the God of hope, to the God of grace, rather than the darker gods that our world worships. It's a countercultural act. And every time we do that here, I think we help bring light into the world. And we encourage ourselves for the journey, encourage ourselves for the work that we need to do. Whenever you're with your children or your grandchildren and you help them navigate their emotions and you teach them to share and you teach them to be kind and you teach them to stand up for themselves when it's appropriate for them to stand up for themselves, you're helping counteract the darkness in this world. Every time we make choices that help protect the environment, that help recycle our stuff or limit the amount of stuff we buy and use or move towards more sustainable use of our resources and steward our resources well, we do help protect and care for the future of this planet. These are all great things that we can do and we do as a body, as a community. I think that's what it means to be the body of Christ, which is what the church has always been called. None of us individually, I get overwhelmed for myself personally when I think about how can I in any way impact the enormity of the great problems that present us? And I can't by myself. But I take hope and encouragement from the fact that actually I don't do it by myself. I do it together in collection with you. We do it together. As we strive to be that source of light, as that source of hope, that source of grace in a world that is so desperately in need.